Never mind the noise and the chatter. We are here for intelligent, fact-based conversation on this episode of Bergen Banter, the official podcast of Bergen Community College. Hi, everyone. I am Larry Levanka, your host of the official podcast. So there's no time for downtime, right? When you want to buy something on Amazon, you just want Amazon to work, right?
Correct.
But that's not the world that we exist in today. So today we have Professor of Cybersecurity, Professor George Lilu Ashavili, here to discuss what our interconnected world looks like behind the smartphone, behind the computer screen, and what is that web infrastructure and architecture like, and what happens when things go wrong. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting.
You bet. So first question, you know, as I said, we're interconnected in a lot of ways. So when one thing goes down, whether it's AWS, Amazon, Google, et cetera, there's this cascading effect throughout the entire web that, you know, can impact operations all over the place. We've seen this with airlines. We saw the massive AWS downtime last year in October, I think it was. Yeah. I mean, what happens in an outage like that? How does it occur?
Well, that's a very good question. There are many reasons for outages to occur. Sometimes outage can be a result of cyber attack, malicious actual act, or it can be a power outage. It can be also many different factors. Like in Amazon's case, this was a software bug. So many interpreted it as a cyber attack, but it actually was, in that particular outage case, was the software bug that was implemented. And that cascade effect occurred because many systems which are codependent on each other, they lost the chain of connection. So once this chain of communication broke down, the connection with different services was disrupted. And that caused a massive outage across, not just in the U.S., but across the globe. So, yeah.
So when we talk about a software bug, though, what is a software bug? I mean, we've all, at one time or another, had a virus on our computer. You know, those of us of a certain age that had Napster, you know, we can remember we used to get all kinds of viruses, right? But what is a software bug that could disrupt something like AWS?
It's a pretty big bug. So this is in software architecture, when our designers or architects try to implement changes, improve software, improve security, there are scenarios where something is either overlooked or was not properly calculated. So when it, like when architects try to fix one thing, another breaks. And in some worst case scenarios, when another breaks, there is a cascade effect.
Right.
When multiple things break and the whole structure is, you know, almost collapsing, you know? So in that case, software bug was that something that was meant to improve connectivity, but it disrupted. It happens. It happens to the best of the best companies. It's just, unfortunately, it's sometimes inescapable.
Right. So is it the mistake in most cases or some cases of a single person or a single line of code? Or is it, you know, multiple layers that somehow made a mistake?
Honestly, it can be combination.
Okay.
Either it can be a mistake of a person. Misconfiguration is a common problem, which can happen to, again, highly skilled professionals. They might miss a step, miss a checklist, and the misconfiguration can cause the access to be left open. Like, for example, like we can close a door, lock it, but one day we might not be able to properly lock it and the door is unlocked and someone unauthorized might gain access. So in that scenario, that when like misconfiguration, I don't know exactly what happened.
Right.
Again, I just want to kind of clarify.
Generally
speaking, it can be, you know, a person's mistake, or it can be a combination of group of people who overlooked the connect. Like, you know, there's a chain of command in any organization in terms of how the fixes and patches are applied. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it is a one person, or sometimes when one person makes a mistake, there are others who test this before it's released, and they also make mistakes. I just don't want to, again, refer to AWS. I don't know internally what happened to them, but under common circumstances of like large organizations or small ones, it's possible that it can be personal or group of people which was responsible for outage of that particular system.
So the end user, in most cases, they see the website or the app
exactly.
On their phone or on their computer. So it's not necessarily that ESPN is down, yeah. right? It's something far beyond ESPN. What are those layers of architecture? How does a site or an yeah. app end up on our screen? It's not just that we click and we see ESPN. No. There's many, many layers behind it. And something could go wrong at any one of those layers, right? Talk about that architecture.
Correct. And you're absolutely right. There are not this website does not just float in a cloud. Mm-hmm. It is hosted on a machine. So everything we see, whether we're talking about ESPN, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, everything we see down to its last design, correction, word, letter, everything is hosted on a machine. Mm-hmm. And machine is hosting that website. So when we access website, we're accessing actual machine. So there are many components. There's a network component, like actual physical connection cables. There's a power supply component, which supplies the power. There's different types of like connective components and compartments, such as like, let's say DNS, domain name servicer, which is like a phone book, which directs device, which system to communicate to. So if one of these is disrupted, the website that, as you said before, end user, which is all it boils down to, and then right. we are the end user, that end user loses the connectivity to the system. And that's a big part. Like if one of this is disrupted, then end user cannot access website.
How much redundancy is built into these systems so that you know, if there is, whether it's a bad actor or just a mistake or, you know, a power outage, that there's a backup somewhere that'll keep the airplane, you know, logs going so that we can get the airplanes off on time and all of that. What kind of redundancy exists?
That's a very good question. There are many different types of redundancy. So I just want to say, again, I'm not affiliated with AWS, or Google, or any of these companies that we discussed. But
that's right. You're ours.
Exactly. So when I say it, I say it impartially. I know their systems. I studied their security systems. I studied their redundancy. They're pretty good. Mm-hmm. But one of the most important thing I would just want to mention in a field of security in general, cyber or a physical security, that there is no 100% of anything. It doesn't exist. We can spend millions and millions of dollars in redundancy backups, like, for example, backing up all our materials, backing up all our files, but then both one or two of these redundancies can fail. It's possible. Although more redundancies we have statistically, it's less possibility that we'll lose control. But then there is also other component I want to talk about, the component of unknown. We can have redundancy of known problems, but there are also unknown problems which there is no redundancy. So, for example, let's say we have a regular car, sedan, with a spare tire in it. We might have jumper cables in it. We can have several redundancies, but if engine component, for example, fails, there is no redundancy to that. Mm. So that's a very good question. How much redundancy? A lot. They have a lot of redundancy. They have a powerful backup servers which mirror files. But there are many, many issues that can arise with unknowns. There's still a lot of unknowns. And when unknown happens, like that particular software bug or in any other issue, it knocks out the system before the engineers. Again, one of the best ones, but they still are human beings. They need time to analyze what happened and correct issue, which is outside of their checklist.
So even in that scenario, it's not as if technology is just moving at such a fast pace that, you know, we could somehow protect against it. I mean, it's more just the unknown. You don't know what you don't know, right?
Exactly. Mm. Exactly.
So, I mean, the other side to this, though, is there are malicious actors out
Absolutely.
There that are going to try and take down, whether it's a website or a host or a provider, in order to cause harm. This is a major, major issue. Billions of dollars being spent not only by the federal government, but, you know, private industry. Is the approach to a malicious actor different than, say, how you protect against human error or a software bug?
Absolutely. It is different, but they usually encompasses an information security in general. So information security, when we talk about it, is not just protecting it from malicious actors, which is a very, you know, big problem, as you mentioned. It also protects from physical damages to the machine. It's also tries to protect from human error, like training staff better to, you know, work on a device. We can have millions of dollars. We can spend millions of dollars on a state-of-the-art machines. But if the user of that machine, person who controls them, has no knowledge, that will be, you know, it can be wasted in terms of security if they do not properly configure the security. So that's a kind of a thing. Like when we talk about and when we think about like overall security, many organizations try to control this in one field, but it can get complex in terms of like trying to manage both security and like what when mm-hmm. individuals misconfigure. But they're trying to. It is encompassed into one large field of information security.
Talk about the scope of cyber attacks. I mean, I know at our Meadowlands Innovation Center, we actually have a real-time threat monitor that assesses and tracks threats. I mean, I don't think the average person has any idea of the scope of what's actually happening every minute of every day. What does that look like, you know, explain it to a layperson?
Absolutely. So every day we are under, like, entire organizations, individuals, we're under constant threat in terms of cyber attacks. No one is pretty much secure. If we have a smartphone, and most of us do, we connect to network, as most of us do on a daily basis to do their job. There are so many different types of malicious actors. There are scammers. There are people who deploy different type of traps, and they're getting better and better. Now, there is a lot going on. And thankfully, not many of us know what's going on. Like, for example, thankfully, again, because this is something that can create a lot of anxiety. Because all our accounts that we have, and again, not to just create anxiety, but all our accounts that we have, our email accounts, whether it is, you know, like our personal or work, it's under constant threat of somebody tries to run it through some type of attack. There are, and many attacks today, what's most concerning is they're automated. So it's in like 90s, for example, a person had to sit down and manually try to hack, like when we see it in the TV shows and movies. It actually gets too close and a person manually does this, try to attack the system. Today, that can be fully automated. And even before AI in kind of coming into the game, it was already automated. So our email might end up in a data breach and somebody might just put this on an automatic attack mode and constantly will be attacked. So I just want to say like this, if you ever want to check this type of like thing, you can check your email. If let's say you had email for like 10 years, 20 years, check the activity log. Mm-hmm. Like for example, in Outlook or email, and see how many attempts have been made on your email. And it's a lot going on. And then there is a cascade effect of data breaches that, for example, if I have one email for my personal account, for my social media, for my like Netflix or Hulu or another websites, if that email is compromised and I have the same password on all other accounts, there'll be chain of compromises. So there is a lot of going on. There is from malicious actors, from amateurs, today we have also state actors, malicious state actors of adversarial nations that, plain and simply to say, they want to see U.S. to, you know, break in terms of they try to break our critical infrastructure. They try to break our, you know, communication. So they're paid by different adversarial governments to target us. And not just, you know, critical infrastructure, but actual individuals, CEOs of the companies. Right. So there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on, and it's like it's getting more and more with an automation that we have right now with an AI. So not to kind of like, again, switch to the different topic. It is a big part of, you know, cybersecurity when it becomes more and more autonomous and it gets more and more sophisticated because of the tools that we have today.
It's kind of, you know, the light and the dark of it. It gets more sophisticated, but because it gets more sophisticated, it's easier to do. Right. And that's what's happening right now, where you have these very much in like these AI data centers. Yeah. They're just running code constantly, and they're able to, you know, do the work of what it took, as you said, a human, time to do. Now it's instantaneous, and that makes it easier for threats then. So when you talk about cybersecurity threats, you know, we hear about what we hear about on the news, where there's an attack where, let's say, a hospital has been breached and they hold the consumer information hostage, or they hold all these things hostage. That's only what bubbles to the surface.
Exactly.
I mean, In your view and in your experience and research, you know, what kind of things are going on behind the scenes? I mean, we know there's a national security risk with cybersecurity. How serious is it?
Extremely. It is extremely serious because what we see, as you said, and this is a very correct statement, what we see is the tip of the iceberg. And then there's a whole iceberg below that. And that's what we do not see. That's how what companies do not release, again, not maliciously, but because it did not affect customers. Right. But many organizations are under constant attacks and they retaliate, they kind of like recover, then they retaliate. There's a lot going on. What we see is it's a worst case scenario when it got already, either company has to divulge it because of legal and ethical reasons. And this is what we see. What we do not see is the entire, like, you know, under the kind of like behind the curtain scenario where there's a lot going on. Because I just want to concentrate one thing you said, it gets easy. And this is a very good statement, and I just want to go to this. Today, field of cybersecurity is something that you do not have to have PhD or master's degree to learn. You can have a computer, YouTube, and there are so many tools available that, to be honest with you, 14-year-old or 15-year-old can sit down without formal education, without formal training, and they can teach themselves this. And then we have today, again, not to go back to AI, but that became another teaching material for individuals to learn how to hack the system. So we don't have to be highly trained in law enforcement and forensics or in cybersecurity to do this. The availability of cybersecurity tools makes it less complex for someone to be self-taught.
So on one hand, you know, we were talking earlier about, well, there's only so many players in the, you know, hosting game or the provider game, et cetera, like AWS and Google, et cetera. But maybe that's by design because on one hand, you would say, well, we're putting all of our eggs into just a few baskets. But if you're AWS, you have the ability to hire the best of the best people and engineers that can protect against these attacks. Whereas if you're, you know, a smaller operation and you're hosting or you're providing, you're not going to have the breadth of these large scale companies. So, you know, how do you weigh that? Because on the one hand, you've got these companies that have so much skin in the game and are obviously thus vulnerable, but they're probably the best equipped to do so. So for the consumer looking at this, you know, is it a net gain or a net negative that there's few companies that are doing most of this high-end work and high-end support of our web infrastructure?
That's a very good question. It can be a double-edged sword to say like this, because as you said, we have few companies, few major players like AWS, Microsoft, Google, which are highly sophisticated, highly powerful, but the lack of diversity can create, how can I say, unhealthy competition. Like it's not healthy to have only a few players. More players we have, healthier the competition, and it thrives companies to do better. So again, AWS, Microsoft, Google, they are serious players. They have serious security. And whatever I've studied, again, I'm impartial to this. Mm-hmm. Whatever I studied, they have serious people working on. And they take it seriously. But when it comes to like large, when it comes to our bulk of our internet, depending on this, when we have outage, we feel it. It's significant. It's severe. Right? So at the end of the day, we need to ask ourselves a question, how we fit into this all scenario. Do we, you know, keep that way it is, or we try to improve it, put some, you know, more competitors in a game, put more players in a game, try to encourage from a given governmental standpoint to encourage healthy competition, create more companies, which they can cooperate with each other, and if one is out of service, maybe another can take over. So they can work in a redundancy mode rather than one company being a bulk of the internet.
And that's an age-old conversation on, you know, regulate versus deregulate, you know, monopoly versus non-monopoly, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, In your view, and we know the federal government is is, you know, attuned to these attacks, especially as you said, state actors. We know where you know, malicious actors are coming from overseas. Are they doing enough to keep us safe and to keep our, let's be honest, way of life safe? It just seems like there's vulnerability there that you don't know what you don't know.
That's a, another good question. Now, federal government is trying to kind of like take control of the situation. They really are. They created CISA. They create. We have NSA. We have Cyber Command. So we have different governmental, from, you know, from law enforcement to Department of Homeland Security. We have different components which are trying to protect, increase, you know, as much as possible in terms of protection, improve, adapt. But they face challenges, though. So I just want to talk about this a little bit. Federal government, like when we talk about a traditional defense model, and when like federal government tries to defend the nation from, let's say, land invasion, air invasion, sea invasion, they control military assets. They have their strategic command controlling different branches, and they are in constant synchronization and constant communication. Now, when it comes to cybersecurity, federal government faces a serious challenge. Where we have, when we have a critical infrastructure organization such as airports, we have hospitals, we have many different communication, electrical grid, some of these companies are run privately.
That's right. Mm.
So when they are run privately, federal government tries to put the regulations, they try to put like different type of guidelines how to properly defend the system, but they cannot assume a they cannot assume a direct control of this because it's private. So this compartmentalization is creating a lot of problem for federal government. Although one can argue that its independent systems can be good and can promote like compartmentalized security, in terms of federal government, they trying to, but this is their challenge. Because they're private, they're organizations, hospitals, you know, airports, they're stuff that's privately owned. So they try to enforce the highest security standards, but it can be like kind of like in terms of this, it can be a big challenge.
What are, in your view, the sort of emerging threats? You know, what is becoming more common? What do you think we're going to see more of? Again, you talked about the acceleration of AI being a big component of that. But for, you know, the lay people, the ordinary citizen, what are we going to see more on the news about when we talk about cybersecurity?
Very good. Let's start with the scams. Scams are getting better. They're getting more sophisticated because, like, just to kind of touch AI and we'll go back to it, AI created something that there was never before available for scammers. The grammar collection, sounding like a native for the country you are trying to scam. So they don't have to have a now fluent English grammar knowledge to be able to type a convincing email. They don't have to have a fluent like accent in English to be able to come, because AI can translate. It can make the translation better. So they can scam people, as you mentioned before, on an individual level, much more sophisticated. Like, I've received a call when person tried to pretend, like recently, like maybe 2 months ago, when person tried to pretend to be a state trooper in Maine. So I support law enforcement, and when person start talking about donation, I listen. But when I ask the person about HQ, they start already kind of getting confused what I was talking, like, where is your headquarters? And they started to get confused. But the person who talked to me, then I realized that it's not a person, it's a machine. And I heard it here and there, the disruptions, which gave me that idea that this was not a person. But let's say our vulnerable population, our elderly, they are the most susceptible to these high-level scams. So scams are social engineering is the first to answer to your question. Social engineering will be more sophisticated. So we need to have better awareness in that regard. Next, to kind of continue to your question, is an actual technical aspect, an automation of attacks has become more and more powerful. So as our computer hardware advances, as our graphics cards, which at one point were designed for gaming, today they are designed for computation. Mm-hmm. And as our graphics cards and our, in general, hardware advances, the ability to attack passwords, the ability to automate the attack. So attacker can put thousands, like from when you mentioned before the hospital data breach, they can take this breached data, they can put it in a, you know, different autonomous tools. They can attack thousands, hundreds of thousands of people simultaneously. They can just leave this attacking system on and they just can walk out from the room and leave it attacking the system. So automation is what we are going to see more and more. In context with AI usage, because AI can provide knowledge to individuals who do not have it. As excellent tools as AIs are today, highly helpful, very good tools, any tool can be perverted and it can be used for evil. And people who want to do bad things, they can trick AIs into teaching them how to do that. Even though the people, the AI developers try to put safeguards, that safeguards can be worked with. And that those safeguards can be bypassed. So we should see more sophisticated attacks in the future, more sophisticated technical attacks, social engineering attacks, and more sophisticated knowledge of attackers because of that vast amount of information that AIs provide today.
The question even becomes about, you know, videos. You know, which videos are legitimate versus which videos are AI created. That seems to be an area that there should be or there should be work done to easily identify an AI created video versus a non-AI created video so that we don't think that, you know, the president of the United States is doing a hula dance or something like
exactly.
that. You know, so how does that get approached from a cybersecurity point of view? Are there ways that we can, and you've started to see it on the various social media platforms, identifying things as AI
Absolutely.
Versus, I mean, is that a technology or is that a safeguard that has promise or are people going to find a way to get around that too?
That's a very good question. So let's start with videos and presidents and all that stuff. This is a highly powerful tool, which are, I just want to say, the video, AI videos became so sophisticated today.
Yeah, very quickly too.
That's a good
it became
point.
Very good very quickly.
Exactly. Very good very quickly. People don't have six fingers anymore and two heads. Yeah. The AI generating videos are sometimes, I watched a couple of times like planes and stuff like this, AI generated. I was amazed how well it is done. And I could have, if I just paid attention, especially on a reel or something.
Casual, without
deeper analysis, I could have believed it easily. I worked with graphics. I've used computer graphics even since like beginning of 2000s, even like 90s. And I know computer graphics. But there are many times that the AI video tricked me because it's so well done. And to go to this has become a cybersecurity issue because of informational warfare. Mm-hmm. People try to discredit each other by creating fakes. And as you said before, sometimes there are safeguards that some of the platforms put it as an AI. Sometimes it's voluntary identification of video. But there are times when it's, you know, white person would never do this because there is no mechanism to analyze and detect this. So it will not label it, it won't hashtag it as AI. And then what happens where this information warfare tries to criticize or tries to dehumanize or insult, let's say, CEOs of the companies or higher-ups and try to bring the organization down by placing AI-generated nude images, right? And it has serious consequences, and regulation of this is very complex. Mm. Because there are many tools, AI detection tools. Like, for example, in academia, we use Turnitin system to analyze. Well, there are many things that tries to analyze it, but there are components which are problematic because videos are not as easy. Even though one can run it and detect it, how many AI-generated videos are generated per day? Right. We have no possible system to encompass this global phenomenon. So there is no mechanism. There are mechanisms, but there is no mechanism which can cover the entire ballpark on this. It's just not. And this kind of become a serious, serious issue when we hit to an information warfare, because it can be the whole fake news channels created. Yep. Like this beautiful studio you guys have here can be like not at that level, but it can be, you know, recreated in AI, and then our faces can be changed and altered, and we can say something else, different, you know, topics. We can be altered completely what we're talking about. So that level is a serious problem, not just in cybersecurity, but in general in society.
So to the end user, right?
Absolutely.
What's the advice, right? Is it verify, right? Like you talked about that state trooper before that wasn't a state trooper. Yeah. You know, if you want to make a donation to somebody, you know, call them directly. Don't take the call from somebody. If you want to do business with your bank, right, don't take a call from the bank. Do it yourself. Go to the bank yourself. Is that the best advice that you can give a consumer on these kinds of things? Or are there other things that they should be doing too?
Absolutely. So these are core, this covers, this whatever you just said covers a core good advice for everybody. Verification is a must. I would recommend anyone to take any information with a grain of salt. Be very careful before you make a decision when you watch something. There are many types of, especially social media can spew and post tons of materials which is simply not true, altered, polluted, corrupted. So anything that we do in terms of information, we need to verify. Before we, and this is something that hopefully we as a society learn together to, before we jump to conclusions, we need to verify. Just because somebody said something or showed some type of video does not mean it's necessarily true, especially in this day and age. Right. And another thing that you mentioned in verification is if somebody calls you and asks you for personal information, don't give them. If you, even if they say they're law enforcement, even if they say they're IRS, first of all, IRS doesn't call homes. But if you think that this is something that you want to check, you can tell them, listen, I will contact you myself. Hang up your phone. If it was a police department, let's say in Bergen County, find the police department in Bergen County, pick up the phone, call them, and inquire who just called you. If that's a person from the officer or someone who just tried to reach out to you, then you can establish a secure connection. Anyone who can call you, the phone numbers can be altered. They can be spoofed. They can be changed. And you might receive a call which you think is legitimate, but it's not. So we need to also kind of create one thing that we all can do in terms of securing ourselves is creating awareness. Talk to our elderly family members, neighbors, community members. Keep them engaged in the current threats. Keep them aware. Keep them always kind of on their toes in terms of not to provide information, because elderly population are the biggest victim in this scenario because they're easily exploited. And this exploitation happens systematically. So verify information is a first step. Second step, take everything with a grain of salt. Do not trust the information you see from a first glance. Verify what it is. Right? And most importantly, do not share your data unless you are 100% sure that it is a recipient that you want to share data with. If you, and I just want to say something for my college students and whoever, you know, tries to apply to different colleges or get a job. To when you fill up the job application, don't put the personal information. Don't put social security. Don't put something that is very personal, such as like personal identifiable stuff. If somebody wants your social security, you can provide them during interview in person. Because I've seen many websites now start requiring social security. That's a big problem. Because if a person has my first name, last name, my phone number, my zip code, my address, and my social security, my identity can be duplicated in a second.
That's right. You have no idea what security is behind that, you know, especially if it's a Google form or something that doesn't have, I mean, talk about that. You know, the little lock, right? We all learned long ago when you're on a website, you know, you need to see that lock in order to do business that has personal information.
Exactly. Exactly.
So these are the kinds of things that we talk about on the personal level. We've talked about the global impact of cybersecurity and why there, you know, is no time for downtime in our world today. Professor, this has been a terrific conversation. I hope that everyone has a better understanding of what, you know, web architecture looks like, what's behind it, how we end up in these scenarios when things go down, why they go down, and really what we can do as individuals to try and protect ourselves. So thank you for coming on. coming on the program. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Larry, for having me. It was a pleasure to meet you and a pleasure to be on your program.
You bet. Thank you. Never mind the noise and the chatter. We are here for intelligent, fact-based conversation on Bergen Banter. I'm Dr. Larry Levanka. I will see you again down the road.